Lecture 12. Carl Jung, The Celebration of Religion.
We'll finish up our look at psychological theories of religion by examining the life and work of Carl Gustav Jung, one of Sigmund Freud's most famous followers, who later set off on his own and founded his own school of thought. Carl Gustav Jung was born in Keswil, Switzerland, in 1875. He was quite an intelligent child, but very introverted, withdrawn, and he even claimed in his later autobiographical notes that he detected in himself two distinct personalities called Person One and Person Two. He had a great interest in building things with blocks and with the study of philosophy, and he especially liked the philosopher Immanuel Kant, who we'll be looking at shortly. But he didn't follow this interest in his professional training. Instead, taking a cue from an eminent grandfather, he went to medical school in Basel in 1894 and graduated in 1900 with a specialty in psychiatry, going to work after that in a psychiatric clinic in Zurich. In 1903, he met and married Emma Rauschenbach, who came from a very wealthy family, which meant that his future was assured, if nothing else. They had five children together, and they had a very close and happy marriage. In fact, Emma was his confidant and his collaborator on many of his works until her death in 1955. The real turning point in Carl Gustav Jung's fortunes came when he encountered Sigmund Freud. Having read Freud's book on the interpretation of dreams, he felt that he had found a kindred spirit, somebody that would understand the kind of explorations that he was mounting in his work on the unconscious. So he sent Freud a set of his own writings, and Freud responded very graciously and invited him to come for a visit in Vienna. And when Jung showed up, the men got along so well that it said they stayed up for 13 straight hours talking nonstop. Freud found Jung very handy to have in his budding psychiatric association. For one thing, in the anti-Semitic atmosphere of the Germanic-speaking nations of Europe at that time, it was very handy for Freud to have at least one disciple who wasn't Jewish, a comment on the times. But he also found in Jung what he thought was going to be his true protege, and he treated Jung as a son and expected from him total loyalty. Well, as so often happens in these mentor-mentee relationships, Jung eventually broke with Freud, wanting to go his own way. Their differences were both personal and professional. On the personal level, Jung became disturbed quite early on at the unorthodox nature of some of Freud's domestic relationships. And he began to chafe under Freud's demands for total loyalty, especially when Freud called on him to maintain his teachings as dogmas. That was the word Freud used. They eventually broke in 1913, and the split was quite bitter. The personal issues aside, the reasons for the breakup included at least these four elements in professional disagreements. One was they had very different views of the unconscious. We'll look into that in more detail in just a moment. The second thing was Freud insisted dogmatically that sexual repression was the sole cause of all psychiatric problems and neuroses. Jung noticed that in his own clinical practice, he had seen any number of patients whose problems could be traced to something other than sexual repression, and so he broke with Freud over that. Interestingly, he also disagreed with Freud's negative assessment of paranormal psychology and research in extrasensory perception. Jung had attended seances and taken copious notes, and in an amazing episode when Freud dismissed categorically any belief in paranormal events, Jung gave him a demonstration, which shocked Freud quite a bit. And then finally, they disagreed on the value and role of religion. As we recall from the last lecture, Freud's opinion of religion was that it was nothing but a negative influence in people's lives it was just best outgrown. Jung had a more nuanced view of religion and saw it as potentially having a positive role in giving people resources for coping. After the break, Jung went through his own crisis in looking for a new direction. He also underwent severe psychic traumas. He said he had appalling visions. He could see Europe dripping with blood. Not long thereafter, World War I broke out. He quit his medical practice altogether. It was taking up too much of his time, he said, and he needed his time and energy for the research and writing projects that he was undertaking. He began to travel extensively. He went all over the world, and he talked to everyone from Indian pundits to Native American shamans, collecting world mythology, reading relentlessly, getting information from any source that he could on dream images, mythologies, themes, anything he could find. He also spent the time delving into his own psyche, trying to find the roots of the unconscious within himself. The results of all this were a massive study in world mythology and an interest that he pursued right up till the last year of his life, research into alchemy and the symbolism and practice in that. Jung died in 1961, leaving behind an estate and a foundation and a group of devoted followers who carried on his message to the world. Looking now at Jung's life and thought, the first thing we want to look at, one of the most direct contributions to his break with Freud, was his view of the unconscious. Now, to review for a minute, Freud, who discovered the unconscious and put the word into our vocabulary, saw the unconscious as a very dark, dank, bad place. It was a basement or a sewer into which people repressed all of the things in their life that were too threatening or too dirty, just that they could not deal with without feeling gravely threatened by them. He also said this was the source of neurosis because as more and more things got repressed into this unconscious, pressure built up, and the neuroses that people displayed were just the leakages of all of these bad things that were stuffed into this place. Jung, on the other hand, saw the unconscious in a much more neutral sense. His definition of the unconscious was, it's whatever mental contents we have of which we're not conscious. They don't have to be bad. All that's required is that we not be aware of them in our conscious state. Pure and simple. But also, breaking with Freud, Jung analyzed the unconscious into two different levels. On the one hand, there was the personal unconscious, and this consisted simply of things that came out of somebody's own personal experience. They were things that were not shared with other people. They were built of our memories, our past experiences, our own habits and inclinations, our ways of relating to other people, things that are specific to us. The contents of the personal unconscious tended to coalesce into a series of complexes. Now, we can leave those aside because they don't play directly into Jung's view of religion. What's far more important for understanding the way Jung analyzed religion is the other part of the unconscious, the collective unconscious. The idea of the collective unconscious has frequently been misunderstood by many of Jung's own followers. Many people have thought that when Jung talked about the collective unconscious, he was talking about some kind of mystical connection that people share with each other, some kind of mind-to-mind connection that puts us all in touch with each other. Now, given his implicit belief in paranormal phenomena, it would be plausible to think that he did believe this to be the case. But in his own writings, he denied that. He said the collective unconscious is not some kind of hive mind that we all partake of. The collective unconscious can be seen as simply contained within each individual's psyche. But what makes it collective is the fact that it's human. Since we are all human beings, Jung assumed that we all have within us the very same basic psychic structures. And so even without having a direct connection from one mind to the other, it is still possible to think that there are many things in our unconscious that are structurally the same from one person to another. And whereas the personal unconscious contained complexes, when Jung spoke about the contents of the collective unconscious, he spoke in terms of another concept that's very important for his evaluation of religion. The collective unconscious contains archetypes. Archetypes are images that the mind uses in order to represent its own structures and its own instinctive contents to itself. And this was the key for understanding why Jung did not think this was some kind of mystical connection. Here's what Jung himself had to say about the archetypes. There is good reason to suppose that the archetypes are the unconscious images of the instincts themselves. In other words, that they are patterns of instinctual behavior. The hypothesis of the collective unconscious is, therefore, no more daring than to assume that there are instincts. So, Jung believed that in formulating images, the unconscious was simply structuring its own contents in certain ways in order to manipulate them and to move them around and relate them to each other and to bring them into our daily behaviors. Now, the archetypes being in the unconscious are generally, by definition, below the level of consciousness and we're not aware of them. But we can have access to them by certain means. For example, dreams are a place where the images of the unconscious come out. Mythologies and the recurring themes that one finds from culture to culture all around the world also contain images that, by their very recurrence and seeming universality, appear to indicate that there are things in our minds that we share in common with people all over the world simply by virtue of being human. You also see it in art. You see it in any kind of dramatic performance, in poetry, in ballads, in songs, in music, in any place where the imagination is allowed to rise and to express itself and bring things out in order to communicate at a deep level with other people. Now, when examining the contents of people's dreams or world mythologies, Jung thought that he could actually identify and catalog all of these archetypes and to see how they relate to each other in order to get clues as to how this collective unconscious works as a way of studying what it means to be human and to relate to our own selves and to others. To give one example, Jung wrote about a painting by Leonardo da Vinci which depicts the baby Jesus sitting on the lap of his mother, the Virgin Mary, while Saint Anne, Mary's mother, is visiting with them. Now, Freud would have looked at this as a manifestation of religion, and he would have dismissed it. But Jung looked at it as an image, and he correlated it with images that he found in other mythologies to derive the archetypal motif of the dual mother. He related this to a very basic, fundamental self-conception that human beings have, that they have a dual nature, each part of which has its own birth. There's a lower animal nature that is governed by our instincts and our needs. There's a higher spiritual nature that allows us to act in a virtuous or moral way and to create societies and get along with each other. These don't seem always to be correlated or integrated very well with each other, and so they're frequently conceived as being two separate things. Closely correlated with this theme of the dual mother, Jung said, was the recurrent theme of the new birth. Now, those of us in the West who are used to Christian belief and practice are very familiar with the idea of being born again. But for Jung, this is only one instance of that motif. You could find it also in ancient Egypt, where in the investiture of a new pharaoh, he was said to be born again and assume his divine status before ascending the throne. We also have in ritual, as Jung would have observed in India, the initiation of a young boy into the study of the Vedic literature, which is said to be his new birth and his gaining of a new sacrificial body marked by the ritual piercing of the ear and the conferring of a sacred string that he will always wear over his shoulder. Once he has gone through that ceremony, he is said to be one of the Dvija, the twice born. So the archetypal image of the dual mother and the two births that people go through were, for Jung, universal images that actually had effects in people's lives, in determining how they assumed their place in society, how they conceived their place in the universe, what they thought they were in and of their own nature. Whether this is by mystical connection or simply by virtue of the fact that our brains are built to think that way, it doesn't matter. What is important is that these contents, these archetypes of the collective unconscious, transcend the individual. They don't belong to the individual alone, but they put the person firmly into the human race. The second theme that I want to explore that tells us about Jung's view of religion is his stance which was at the same time phenomenological and pragmatic. Now, we'll be examining the nature of phenomenology in great detail in subsequent lectures. Let me give you a very brief indication of what the term means right here. Phenomenology is the philosophical view that we do not really have any contact with the world as such. This lectern that is right here before me is simply out there in the world, but all I know of it is what I see, what I feel, perhaps even what I hear. But those things are all mediated by my senses to my mind, which then constructs them into an image, and it's only that image that I can ever know. I can't ever know the thing in itself. I can only know the image. This was Jung's basic stance, and this differentiated his approach tremendously from Sigmund Freud's. It meant that Jung bracketed out the metaphysical question and turned his attention strictly to the experiences of the mind and the effects that they had in people's lives. As you recall, when discussing Sigmund Freud in the last lecture, Freud regarded religion as an illusion. Illusions, he said, were things that we believe not because they're necessarily true, although they might be, but we believe them because we want them to be true. They are wish fulfillments. He denigrated religious belief simply because he thought they did not reflect reality. A confirmed atheist, Freud said, there is no God out there, so to believe in a God is simply a very unskillful frame of mind that is not going to help you in life because you will be relating to the world in a way that's not real. That's where Jung parts company from Freud. Jung really does not care if anything that we believe in our religions is really out there or not. For him, that is an unimportant question. What is important is that we do believe them, that we do have these images and contents in our mind, and that by virtue of having these images and contents in our minds, they affect us and make us behave in certain ways. To give an example of this, let's take the belief in the devil. Many religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and many of the Asian religions, have devil figures. They're tempters, they are figures who wish us ill, they want to do evil, they're selfish. They look out only for themselves and don't care about other people. Now, for Jung, the devil was simply an archetype of the collective unconscious. Freud would have said, there is no devil out there, and so to believe that there is one is simply a false belief and must be discouraged. But Jung said, well, what happens when we take part of our own psychic contents and reify them into this image of the devil? This, Jung said, might actually be a healthy thing to do because all of us have within ourselves a shadow, a dark side of our personalities, a place that we do find threatening, that we don't really want to face, but is nevertheless very real and a part of us. You don't want to simply take that devil figure and make it into an image that you then separate from yourself, because to do that would not be healthy. To actually see a devil in the external world that you'd identify as not me is to divorce yourself from a part of yourself and to fence it off and put it in a separate place where you don't have to face it and try to integrate it into your own personality. It stymies the process of individuation and integration. Rather than try to take the Freudian approach of convincing people that there is no devil and they should simply stop believing in it, Jung's approach would be to guide them into appropriating that satanic imagery, bringing it back into themselves, realizing that when they put this image forward, bring it into conscious awareness, they are bringing up a part of themselves. And this presents a tremendous opportunity for the integration and incorporation of this image as a part of our overall personality. So you don't want to just erase it. You don't want to extinguish it or make it go away. You want to bring it in, coordinate it with everything else that is an integral part of you so that you can be an integrated person with a sense of balance. The third aspect of Jung's thought that I want to highlight here doesn't have much to do with his break with Freud, although it does impact it somewhat. And this is Jung's view of the predicament of modernity, as he saw it unfolding in the 20th century, and especially after the traumas of World War I. Part of the problem with modernity, as Jung saw it, was that it had an overemphasis on rationality and logical consistency. Now, one might wonder, what's the problem with that? As we've already seen, there are several thinkers in the history of the theories of religion who identified irrationality as one of the fundamental things that's wrong with religion. Religious beliefs bring us into believing things that are mutually contradictory, that can't exist together. They make us act in ways that are just following instincts, to do things that we haven't really thought through, to believe things that just don't hang together. As you recall, Freud thought that rationality was the answer. Rationality was how you produced mental health. By bringing things out of the basement of the unconscious, by bringing them into conscious awareness, one could then critique them. One could see how they were nonsense. One could use the adult rational mind to think the issue through and find a better way of coping with the stresses and the problems of one's life. And the final result for Freud would be a mature adult individual who could approach the world rationally. Jung fundamentally disagreed with that. Jung's belief was that the collective unconscious with all its archetypes representing instincts represented every piece of ourselves. And if this produced irrationalities, that's because we are fundamentally made of mental components that cannot ever be brought together into a rational structure. The archetypes of the unconscious simply represent every kind of instinctual need, every inclination, habit, proclivity that we have. They all are equally part of us. And if, when brought to the surface and considered by the rational mind, they cannot be put together into a logically consistent picture, then so be it. That is what we are. And to demand pure rationality was simply unhealthy. It meant that we took elements of ourselves and pushed them out, fenced them off, denied that they were part of us, and it impeded our ultimate individuation and integration. Jung actually believed that pre-modern people were superior to the moderns in that way. Pre-modern people believed in the value of attending to dreams. They put on dramas in which they could enact their most fundamental natures. They created works of art. They told mythologies that were deeply satisfying precisely because they took all of these images out of the unconscious and put them together and showed them back to ourselves as integrated wholes. Modern people had lost that by this overbearing emphasis on rationality. To give a concrete example of how Jung thought that this had actually gone wrong in modern religion, he pointed to the Christian belief in the Trinity in a series of lectures he gave that were later published as the book Psychology and Religion. Jung looked at the Christian Trinity as a tripartite picture of ultimate reality, and he said, there's something missing in that. As he looked over the mythologies and the mandalas and the images of art the world over, he saw fairly consistently that the image of the divine, or of the superior part of the human being, was generally represented as a circle divided into four quadrants. The Trinity, then, was missing something. One of the quadrants wasn't there. What was it? Now, here's where it gets interesting, because at this point, Jung makes two suggestions as to what might be missing from this picture. Not one, but two. On the one hand, he says, the feminine is not there. All three persons of the Trinity are represented as male in traditional Christianity. Catholicism and other branches of Christianity have somewhat dealt with this by bringing in the Virgin Mary as someone to whom one can pray, and maybe some female saints as well, but the Godhead always remained exclusively male. The other suggestion was to put Satan. The missing piece of this quaternity that he wanted to create might also be darkness, or it might be our lower natures, our instincts, the evil within us. Now, the reason why rationality creates this problem is because to see either the feminine or the shadow inserted into the very Godhead is to put something into God that is contradictory to the belief that God's fundamental nature is good. And the rational mind can see nothing in this juxtaposition of male and female or of light and darkness, but a logical contradiction which must be resolved by simply eliminating one or the other of the contradicting elements. But Jung said, most of the traditional religions of the world have realized that every picture of the absolute must include opposing elements. Consider the yin-yang symbol of Taoism, where the light and the dark swirl around each other in equal measure, or the ancient Zoroastrian religion, where light and dark are balanced forces that are continually in tension with each other. Most of the traditional religions of the world, in other words, were able to accommodate the coincidentia oppositorum, the coincidence of opposites, and actually saw that drawing opposites together was not a logical contradiction, but a profound act of integration that created health. Now, Jung was not so naive as to say that all forms of religion are good. In this, he followed the pragmatic stance of William James, who also was able to distinguish healthy religion from unhealthy religion. There were tendencies that Jung could see that were clearly unhealthy, and there were times when the images, such as the Trinity itself, became obsolete because they were no longer able to serve the purpose of individuation and integration. For example, he saw in some of his patients an identification of the patient as individual with an archetype. Imagine someone who says, "I am God." This does one of two undesirable things. On the one hand, investing oneself in the archetype might lead to the dissolution of the individual. The individual simply gets lost in the Godhead and disappears from view. But the other possibility is that the individual may keep their own sense of ego intact, but inflate that ego to fill out the archetype. And when that happens, then I become God, and you'd better listen to what I say. You inflate your own ego. So there were ways in which archetypes could be unskillfully integrated into an unhealthy whole. But the important difference with Freud was that Freud saw all religion as always bad because it didn't mirror reality and led people to act in unskillful ways. Whereas Jung was willing, like William James, to admit that while some religion may not be the best, religion as a whole was in general a good thing that gave people stability, resources for coping with the problems of life, and potentially integration, individuation, and mental health. Now, by the way, this does make Jung much more friendly to religion, but I should point out that because Jung was not interested in the metaphysical question, whether the things we believe in are actually out there or not, many people today who consider themselves religious would not consider Jung to be their friend. But Jung did have a profound impact, founding a whole school of thought, a way of approaching religion, that started with the assumption of a universal human nature, a universal set of stories, of images, of symbols, of rituals, of dramas that all of humanity could draw upon to attain health and integration both individually and within society. Later on in this course, we'll see Mirja Eliade, who pursued much of the same research agenda as Jung did, and in fact, the two were very good friends. But in our own culture, a more immediate follower would be Joseph Campbell, the author of The Hero with a Thousand Faces, who was a great influence on George Lucas, and whose writing on universal myths and universal symbols provided much of the basis for the Star Wars movies, and may help to account for its success by providing a basis for universal appeal. Something to think about.